Welcome to the Friday edition of Political Rewind on GPB. I'm Bradley George here at our studios in Midtown Atlanta, joined by our panel, as we always are, with Jim Galloway, the political columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Jim, welcome back.
Well, it's good to be here.
And joined for the first time this week by Bill Torpy. He's a columnist for the AJC. Bill, we're glad you're here.
Thank you.
Also joining us, State Senator Steve Henson, the Democratic leader in the Georgia State Senate. Steve, welcome back.
Good to be back.
And joining us also, Julian Thompson, the Vice President of Public Affairs for Compact for America, the former Press Secretary and Communications Director for the Georgia Republican Party. Julian, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You can join the conversation as well as we discuss the political news that's developed over the last couple of days. We're on Twitter at PoliticsGPB. That's PoliticsGPB on Twitter. And we're going to start today talking about where the political conversation is in Georgia. And today, it's not here in Atlanta. It's not at the state capitol. It's in the town of Greensboro in East Georgia. Jim, what's going on there today?
Well, you originally had a town hall meeting advertised for three Republicans, David Perdue and Johnny Isaacson, both senators, and Jody Heiss, the congressman from that area. They did not show up, but lots of Democrats did.
And lots of staffers for these
you had a situation where it ended up a poor young staffer for Jody Heiss sat there for 2 hours taking notes on speeches given by angry Democrats.
Well, we have some sound of this, and this is one of those staffers telling the folks that this is not going to be a town hall, but they're going to talk to individual staffers one by one. So that's some of the reaction that we got as well. We also heard from Jordan Wilcher. He's a staffer for Congressman Jody Heiss, and he said he didn't exactly agree with what was going on there, but he respected the rights of folks to make their voices heard.
I love it. Yeah. This is exactly what I fought for. Just because it's not my opinion or doesn't maybe express every view that I have? No. I love this. This is exactly what people should do.
And Wilcher was a former Marine, I believe, when he was talking about what he fought for there. This isn't the first example of this. We had a town hall meeting in Utah last night with Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz. A large crowd showed up for that. That was also something that where a lot of angry Democrats and other folks who were there. But there was somebody in Greensboro today that Jim, your colleague, Greg Bloomstein, I believe, spoke to. And there's a Republican, Heidi Morton. She said she traveled from Smyrna. She says, it's not just progressives and liberals, because I'm not one. There are lots of conservatives and Republicans that can't stand Trump. And Republican politicians need to know their constituents are out here. Julianne, what do you make of that?
I think it's about freedom of speech. I'm glad they're involved in the civic process and are starting to get more involved in the issues. Although I don't know that I always agree with their approach, I definitely didn't agree with the approach of a lot of people that were at the inauguration, especially the ones that verbally accosted my 12-year-old son. But as far as these protests are concerned and these town halls are concerned, I certainly support their right to be there, and I commend them for being there.
But what we've got is the flip side of 2009, and we should not let this opportunity pass. Julianne Thompson, over here to my left, was one of the organizers of the 2009 Tea Party movement.
That's right.
Especially in Georgia, and she can tell you very much about the comparisons between this.
Did you see this, Julianne, as analogous to what happened with the Tea Party in 2009?
I think that there are definitely some distinct differences. In 2009, we originally began as a result of the TARP bailouts and our objection to that, and then also Obamacare after the TARP bailouts. But we were very focused on what our message was in the very beginning, which was fiscal responsibility, constitutionally limited governments, and free market solutions. I don't see any real goals or message that the left has right now. I just see a lot of protesting. So in the fact that there are a lot of them mobilizing, yes. But as far as messaging is concerned, I don't see them united on a particular goal.
Well, Politico has a story up today about maybe not necessarily organization, but it's kind of a framework for these protests. And it's this group called Indivisible. And these are former staffers of Democratic congresspeople. And they actually put together a protest guide for these folks who are going to these town hall meetings, giving them tips on how to engage with people from folks who have been on the inside and have been on the flip of that.
Bradley, but most people haven't read that guide and they're still turning out in record numbers, and they definitely have concerns that they want to address, including education and health care, and they do present ideas and opinions. You know, in Atlanta, we had that march not long ago. We expected 10,000-12,000 people. It was raining terribly that morning. 60,000 people. Some say 63,000 people turned out to march in Atlanta. And we're talking about health care. We're talking about making sure that our children are covered, that pre-existing conditions are still addressed and whatever changes to health care happen. We're talking about education and concerned about the person they just had pointed ahead, the Department of Education in D.C., and what their commitment is to public schools. So there's a lot of issues that we're trying to address.
Yeah, and one thing I would kind of interject here is that just like in 2009, the crowd showed up before the focus showed up.
Yeah.
That you had the crowd first, and then you had in 2009, you know, the next year, yes, they focused on the Affordable Care Act. We haven't quite decided where this crowd is going.
We don't
to
know
go.
Where necessarily well, know where the focus is.
Right.
Well, I think that's true to a point. I think Obamacare showed up the next year. However, in the very beginning, we did show up because of a reason, and that was the TARP bailouts. It didn't have anything to do with Barack Obama specifically. It also had to do with George W. Bush, and it came as a result of Rick Santelli's rant on CNBC against the TARP bailouts, and that's what prompted the first call of 22 to organize tea parties across the country. So they did begin focused.
Well, and of course, that was during the Bush administration when they started, but there was a lot of ruckus after Obama got started, even not about Tea Party, but just in general, his policies and administration. You know, one thing that's kind of amazing is that these are people who have never been involved in politics before, lots of them. Democratic Party meetings around the state who once maybe had 20 or 10 people show up. Now they've got to bring in rooms from chairs from other rooms and have 100 people show up. So there's a lot of people getting involved, a lot of people concerned. You know, the environment's a big issue. I think you mentioned that rally they had out of state for the center last night. There was a lot of people who are environmentally conscious that were protesting and concerned. So I hope that we move in the right direction. We can all get on the same page, but there's a lot of concern out there.
I think they're younger crowds now than they were. I remember riding buses in 2009 up to Washington with the Tea Party crowd, and it was the people I rode with were 10, 15, 20 years older than the people that I'm seeing out on the streets now.
And I expect some of those people are going to be joining the young people if Medicare it comes under attack by Tom Price or others.
So this was, as we said, this was billed as office hours for these representatives, Isaacson, Purdue, Heist. They weren't there. Politico had another piece this week talking about how Republicans are trying to respond to these masses of people showing up for town halls and for other events. And the article says, at a closed-door all-conference meeting on Tuesday, House Republicans were advised to limit crowd sizes, hire security, and ensure that they literally have an exit strategy to ensure they don't get stampeded by protesters. Steve Henson, I wonder, for you, speaking as an elected official, not necessarily about the politics behind this, but as somebody, maybe you have to deal with people who don't disagree with you, and a mass of folks show up. From your perspective, is the best strategy to engage with that mass of people, or is it to just kind of step back and let your staffers do it?
Well, I think the best thing for a politician is to go out and address the concerns and try to show people that they're at least trying to have a discussion with them. Certainly, these crowds, you know, the tape you played was after they were told the elected officials weren't going to be there. You know, if a crowd doesn't act civilly and you can't communicate or talk to them, then you might want to pick up and leave. But as long as you're able to have a discussion and able to talk about issues, I think eventually it's good for the politicians to try to do that.
Julianne?
I think he's right. I think that if people are civil and they're willing to actually discuss things and you can have an honest and respectful and diplomatic question and answer period, then it definitely the elected official should be there. However, I mean, and I have two of them pulled up right now. However, when it's advertised on Craigslist for protesters to show up at certain town hall meetings, I can certainly understand why elected officials want to send staff members and not show up themselves, because those type of stage protests are not necessarily organic in nature, and a lot of them are very, very staged, and like I said, a lot of them are being prompted by Craigslist.
Right, but there are, I imagine there are people in there, and this woman, this Republican from Smyrna that we, that quote I read from the AJC, there are people there with legitimate concerns.
And those people should definitely be addressed.
Right. But they're still showing up, even if they're coming from Craigslist. I mean, they are.
Yeah, but they're being
citizens
paid.
And voters.
Do we know that?
Yeah. The ones on that? Craigslist are being paid. And there's there have been interview after interview of people that have been paid to show up. I'm not saying all of them are being paid. I certainly don't think women that showed up in D.C. were being paid.
Yeah, I don't believe it. Listen, there's plenty of people that have come and protest these policies for free. So I don't think they'd have to pay many people.
Well, Steve Hinson, is there a way maybe where this, for years, people have talked about some kind of Democratic or left-leaning counter to the Tea Party, and that hasn't necessarily materialized. Do you think that there's a way to get these protesters to actually turn into something that might be favorable to Democrats electorally?
Well, actually, some of the Tea Party may become involved in issues against Trump administration, depending on what roads he goes down. But certainly, this has been called the chaos presidency, chaos campaign anyway, and some talk about it chaos. I mean, it's always moving. He often attacks both the courts and the public. So that is going to inspire a lot of agitated and intense, pushback from the citizens that disagree. So I think we're going to see an engaged public if he doesn't change the way he and his administration is acting.
It's going to be a while before we can, I would say, it's almost a year before we can tell whether Democrats or this is going to affect the strength of Democrats in Georgia.
Yeah.
Because the midterms are still, that's still November.
And so much can happen. So many political.
Right. I think right now the focus has got to be on how do Republicans adapt to their own shifting kind of philosophies within the Trump administration.
Yeah, and you're not looking really at right now, I don't think, on what the next election's like. What you're looking at is what the policies are on certain issues. What we're going to do about climate change, what we're going to do about public education. I think that's going to drive it. If things go, to an extreme away from the majority of Americans, then you'll find the shift in voting patterns. You know, in Metro Atlanta, for instance, Gwinnett County went for Hillary Clinton, but the baseline Democratic vote is below that, around 47%. So there's a lot of voters, Fran Millar's and David Schaefer's three Republican state Senate districts went for Hillary Clinton. They'll change if the voting patterns of many people change because they think that the Republican Party is going with Trump and disengaging from their views.
Well, what's interesting to me is, we're not even a full month into the Trump presidency and we're seeing protests like this. And if we go back to 2009, Obama maybe sort of the end of February is when Rick Santelli had that moment on CNBC and we saw sort of the rise of the Tea Party. But at that point, we had the stimulus bill, we had the bailouts, we had all of these kind of
We did have the tarp at that point. Yeah.
Yeah, we had all these sort of tangible things that people could latch on to and be angry about. Right now, we've got the travel ban, we've got all these kind of proposals, the wall and things that Trump hasn't talked about yet, but he's yet to get much of his agenda through Congress, and there's a lot of his agenda we still don't quite know what it is, because it seems to shift every time he opens his mouth.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying that we have to wait for the focus. We've got the crowds, we've got the anger. Now you have to know where the crowd is going to head.
Right.
I think.
And even if he raises expectation by saying he's going to do something right away, the public's going to give him a little bit of time before the frustration comes if the things they thought was going to happen do not happen.
Okay, we're going to leave this part of the discussion there. I'm just going to read a couple of tweets that we've gotten on this from Ross Hardy. who's supposed to be paying people to attend meetings in Georgia. If George Soros, he's talking about the billionaire who's a major donor to Democratic causes, with dumping money here, you'd think we would have heard. Karen Hilliard says people were not paid to attend today's event in Greensboro. And Ashley Stringer says also that that's a lie, that she was a protester and that she was not getting paid to attend. No doubt there will be other congressional events, and there will be more more protests and more kinds of demonstrations, and we'll talk about that down the road. But coming up in the next few moments, we're going to talk about Atlanta city politics and a whole lot of paper that landed with a thud yesterday. You're listening to Political Rewind on GPB.
I'm Robert Krulwich from Radiolab. We're told that smell triggers memory. So if you're in your car, you roll up your windows and inhale. What do you remember? Like the smell of a favorite dog jumping in the back seat long ago? A diaper moment, perhaps? There are some memories you cherish and others that just linger. How about contributing this barrel of aroma to your favorite public radio station? And you might even get a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars and thanks.
You're listening to Political Rewind on Georgia Public Broadcasting, an 18-station radio network of GPB. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, ranked among the top universities in the nation in commitment to undergraduate teaching.
You're listening to Political Rewind. I'm Bradley George, filling in today for Bill Nygut. We're joined this afternoon by Jim Galloway and Bill Torpy of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Republican strategist and vice president of public affairs at Compact for America, Julianne Thompson, and Democratic State Senator Steve Henson. All right, let's talk about some developments here in the city of Atlanta. We've had this ongoing scandal of bribes for city contracts. We've had one man, E.R. Mitchell, the head of a construction company, who's already pleaded guilty in that case. We have another person facing charges. And then yesterday, Mayor Kasim Reed held this dramatic press conference surrounded by about 400 or so boxes of documents. And Bill Torpy, I imagine a lot of your colleagues at the AJC and journalists around Atlanta may be filing workers' comp claims because they've got eye strain and paper cut issues trying to sort through all these documents related to this case.
It was amazing. The mayor said it was not a document dump, although, as I said, anyone who with a sense of reality saw it as just that. He released 1.476 million pages of documents concerning the investigation that's going on into the bribery case at City Hall. And we had been asking for some of the documents of the contractor who has pled guilty, E.R. Mitchell. He was the guy who had the brick thrown through his window, telling him to shut up because he's been singing, and with a little bit of aplomb, someone threw dead rats on his front porch to kind of give him the old mafia omerto a sense of foreboding. Anyways, with that all in the background, we've been asking for some documents. Most of them, if not all, should be available in a more easily searchable electronic form. And you know, when we get that, we can get put things in search mode, and we can find what we need a lot more easily. Instead, we have 410 boxes of paper. From my count, I figure about there's 400 boxes with 3,000 pages in each one. It's a daunting task to try to find anything.
This kind of redefines passive aggressive here, I think.
Yeah, well, here we got a little clip of the mayor talking about justifying this release. So first of all, he said that the reason they did hard copies is that it would be quicker because they had to be redacted and some other things. But the mayor spoke at length yesterday about his commitment to transparency, and here he is justifying this this release.
This whole matter has been upsetting to me, but the notion that we were trying to keep something from the public was particularly upsetting to me. So as soon as we could, we did.
Now, the thing here is many of these documents are completely redacted. Some are illegible. And, Bill, you pointed out in your most recent column that lots of blank pages in those 400 boxes.
Boxes of blank pages. It was explained to us that is the if they were copying a large file, that sometimes you get some additional pages that come after it. So you print out a recipe. Sometimes instead of one pages, you get five pages of ads at the bottom of it. Well, I guess that's kind of what happens when you do it. You get 3,600 pages of empty pages, and that counts as what they were releasing. A lot of the other things were so small, they were microscopic, and I mean microscopic. We had a lawyer try to bump it up by 10 times on her viewer, and we still couldn't see anything.
But we are finding, the AJC reporters are finding getting a little bit more of an idea of how and where this came from. And basically what they're finding is that this investigation actually originated in Mississippi, where is that not right?
Well, Mitzi Bickers is and she is a political get out the vote businesswoman, reverend here in Atlanta. She helped Kasim Reed win in the last minute of the last campaign, and she was rewarded with a job. She's done work in other states, and it started bubbling up in Mississippi. It's still to be found how the feds got onto this, but they've been onto it for at least a couple of years, because that's when the rock went through E.R. Mitchell's window. There's a lot to be said. We don't know what's in those records, too. I was just talking to one of our members of our team a little while ago, and they've been at it for 2 days now, and it's needle meet the haystack here. It's just totally random of what you might find, when you might find it, until there's some sort of searchable way of finding it.
So the reporters are going to still keep going through those documents
until they find what they're looking for.
What's the physical outlet? I mean, if they got a room in City
Hall? Yeah, it's the old city. If you've ever been into the old meeting room in City Hall, it's where they put out all the documents concerning the Hartsfield about 4 or 5 years ago. And so you walk around and, basically, I guess it was kind of like stunned bemusement yesterday when people were looking at it. I mean, I was... looking at some of the reporters, just where do I start? I was just kind of jumping around box to box because it's a daunting task, as I said.
What do you think is Kasim Reed's rationale by presenting the documents in a manner like this?
Well, and the thing I went back and forth with him at the press conference, and I was saying that while you were redacting some of the information, like Social Security numbers, they didn't want that released in some of the vendors, fraud, and I could see that. But while you're doing that, you could also, they were converting electronic files to paper, but while you're doing that, you could just turn them back into electronic files. I mean, I can do it, and I'm a numbskull when it comes to technological efforts. I was trying to make that point to him. He finally said that, well, if I wanted to run for mayor, the door's open this year, and run the city as you want. My thought was, and I think you brought it up nicely, Jim, was it was a nice run of passive aggressiveness. It was like, you want these records? Here they are. Boom. I'd love to see how much it cost and how many man hours it took them at Kinko's to be doing this, though.
Well, the mayor said that the investigators haven't questioned him. He's clearly, in that clip that we played earlier, he's stung by this idea that that he might have been a part of the scheme. Do we have any indication at all of
no
what,
no
that
indication
he might have been?
Where, who, what, how, you know? I mean, we know this too. We know that it's two vendors who are doing a lot of business with the city. One of them, E.R. Mitchell, has done. We have found $7.3 million of emergency work, including the Snowmageddon cleanup. Those are gigs where they go in and they don't have to do a bidding. They're already on the list because that's stuff that has to happen quickly. And they presume they had someone inside. Obviously, someone doesn't pay $1 million worth of bribes and not get the work done. So, right. I mean, he may be a crook, but he's not an idiot. So in that happening, there's someone inside, and then how many, he's been singing, and we'll find out a lot more as the days go by, months.
Well, we're in the midst of a mayor's race right now. Does this this investigation have any bearing on that?
Well, a lot of people, it is beginning to, and a couple of the outsiders, Vincent Fort and Kathy Woolard, are
kind of pecking away at the sides. And because I think I saw that one quarter of city council is running for mayor, you know, literally. And then there's one other person who's the former chief of staff of the mayor. And so there's a lot of people who have been there or have been around there that, you know, will have to somehow separate themselves from it, but also others will be trying to, you know, bring them in on it.
And you've already got people like Marion Norwood, who ran against Reed 8 years ago, calling for a new audit of City Hall finances. I think you've had, as Bill said, you had Vincent Fort taking it on, and I think you're going to see. I think you're going to see a lot more of it as you know, as we get closer to June and July.
All right. Well, moving on to another topic. Today is an auspicious day for former Georgia Congressman Tom Price. We can say that now because this morning, Vice President Mike Pence swore him in as the new Secretary of Health and Human Services. And, of course, that sets up a special election. We'll talk about that in a second. But one of the key part of the Trump administration's health agenda is the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. And we are no closer to that or any having any sense of what that plan is going to be.
I think you just got an essential piece. You haven't had a Secretary of Health and Human Services who can serve as kind of the arbiter between Congress and all the plans that they've got, and a President Trump who will tell Congress how far he's willing to go in this. So Tom Price was an essential ingredient in the conversation. Now it can begin, I think.
Julianne.
I agree. Without a Secretary of Health and Human Services, there was no way for it to move forward. Of course, there's the plans that have been put forth by several different individuals, all looking quite similar. But Tom Price had his own plan when he was in Congress, and I'm sure you're going to see, those plans come together and how it's going to look in the end. I have absolutely no idea because Jim's right. They're going to have to be talking to the White House about it, but with Tom Price now being sworn in, I think it's the turning point for the replacement.
I think anything that's coming is going to take a lot of time.
And the president said so last week when he spoke to Bill O'Reilly.
Turned and said it was going to count on Ryan to do a lot of the work.
The president said maybe next year. I think Paul Ryan is saying, oh, no, not that long. Maybe some senators are saying the same thing, too. But we had that leak from the Republican caucus maybe 2 weeks ago, where it was clear that they didn't have a dominant idea of how to do this, how to go about repealing and replacing.
Yeah, it's a complex issue, but, you know, the main thing is they don't want to come up with a plan that people see their coverages cut and prices go up even quicker. And we saw before the Affordable Care Act come into being, you know, rates and costs were going up 12, double-digit every year. Without a real comprehensive and credible plan, much of which would be similar to what we had in the Affordable Care Act, they're going to have a real problem.
I mean, the problem is, healthcare is a business, driven by the insurance companies. And the one thing an insurance company doesn't like is unpredictability. You know, they want those actuarial tables.
And it's complex. It's a complex issue. It's not something you can just do overnight after you have something that is an omnibus bill like Obamacare. That's changing. It's not something you can do overnight. And, you know, I wish those overnight promises had not been made. I mean, we definitely need to repeal it. There are people that are suffering that can no longer afford insurance.
Well,
we also have to be careful of the people that now do have insurance. And we also have to think about the medical professionals that have just spent millions of dollars transitioning over to the equipment that they needed for Obamacare to take care of their paperwork. And so all of those things have to be taken into consideration when coming up with some sort of a replacement.
Well, there are a lot of people who couldn't afford it before Affordable Care Act. In fact, more people. There's more people insured now. But it's right that it is complex. And we need to be striving for covering as many people as possible and making sure we put more Americans into a sound financial position.
Well, self-employed individuals cannot afford it anymore. I mean, I'm one of them. My insurance premiums went from $500 a month for my family of four to almost $1,500 a month to my family of four. That's a mortgage payment. I mean, there are people that can no longer afford coverage, and there are lots of them. So something has to be done.
Julianne, I've got to wonder, this issue of repealing Obamacare, this has been at the heart of Republican politics for years. But again, we haven't seen, you know, there are all these proposals out there that have come and gone for replacing it or repealing it. Why do you think that Republican leaders in Congress haven't been able to this point to just kind of gel around, you know, a single alternative to Obamacare to offer once you get to this point where you potentially are going to repeal the law?
Well, I mean, we haven't had a Republican president until just a couple of weeks ago. So I think that had a lot to do with it. And did we have a veto-proof Congress? I don't know that we did with regard to Obamacare. So I think that the fact that we now have a Republican president, we have a Republican Senate and House of Representatives, and I think that we're going to come up with a plan now, but I do think it's going to take time. I don't think it's going to happen overnight.
It means, I guess, the immediately repeal and replaces, it just, I guess it means,
it's not
what
repair
does immediately mean.
That's right. I agree with you.
Well, and regardless to, you know,
Let me throw in a bet. November 18th. It'll happen sometime after November 18th.
Definitely after the election.
November 8th. Why November 18th? Not
well, that's the midterm elections.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You know, it's going to be complex, but, you know, we really need to focus on trying to make sure that we cover more Americans. And, you know, I think that we're going to look down the road and see that what we should have done is take an Affordable Care Act where Democrats and Republicans both knew it was flawed and make repairs and improve it then. What's so frustrating for me is that there was total obstructionist on the Republicans. They didn't try to help repair the Affordable Care Act as it was or make it as good as it could be, even if they wanted to change it later. So the whole experiment was, you know,
I think that that's that's very unfair. I mean, I think that maybe you could make those accusations for after it was passed, but you certainly cannot say that Republicans were not willing to work on anything before it was passed when you had Nancy Pelosi saying, "Let's pass it and then we'll read it and see what's in it." I mean, that was the attitude of Democratic leadership at the time. And so I think that that's a very unfair statement to make.
Well, the Democrats, including the president, reached out to Republicans. It was actually a plan brought from a Republican state, Mitt Romney state, and, you know, worked with Republicans on a lot of the issues trying to get votes, and not one Republican ended up voting for it, even though many compromises were made.
Some but you have to be willing to sit down and come to consensus, and that's on both sides.
And we've had issues of Republicans as well, I think, of governors in Tennessee and Idaho who have pushed for Medicaid expansion, and they can't get that issue past the Republican supermajorities in their state legislature. So there are Republicans who are at least amenable to some of the ideas here, particularly Medicaid expansion. But again, you're running up into a GOP base and GOP lawmakers who have opposed this bill for so long that they don't necessarily, maybe it's on principle, maybe it's something else, to let go of that opposition.
The one door that may be open now with the administration is that the waiver process, there might be a lot of more variance in waivers. So this, you know, our administration might ask the Trump administration to get more variable on waivers, and they might try to get some more people covered in ways that the Affordable Care Act under Obama would have maybe not liked.
Is there any talk in the Capitol of some actual legislation to that effect, or no, would that be solely on Nathan Deal's side?
He probably would have the ability to ask for some waivers through the department. But the Public Policy Foundation, I think, is working heavily on that.
Well, Tom Price's ascension to the Secretary of HHS now leads to the opening of his congressional seat. And Governor Deal today issued the writ for the special election. I believe it's happening April 18th. Qualifying, though, opens
on Monday. And then we have a runoff. A runoff is likely on June 20th.
Julianne, what are you hearing about potential Republican candidates for that seat?
Of course, I am hearing that one of the biggest names I'm hearing is Karen Handel.
Former Secretary of State.
Former Secretary of State and former Fulton County Commissioner Karen Handel. Judson Hill, of course, who's already pretty much in the race. State Senator Judson Hill. Bob Gray, businessman and Johns Creek City Councilman, who is already in the race. And there's some other names out there as well.
So former Senator Dan Moody could be a self-funder. Bruce Lavelle of Dunwoody,
Bruce
a jeweler.
Lavelle, who was on Trump's Diversity Coalition, who was the executive director of his Diversity Coalition, is a name that's being mentioned.
Right, and Kurt Wilson, the Roswell businessman, a small business owner. It's a really populated field, and I will tell you what, this will be one of the first elections in the country after Trump's inauguration. So it will be
Is there a temptation then for political observers to see this as a referendum on Trump?
I think what you're going to see is you're going to see a Republican Party, as I kind of mentioned earlier in the program, you're going to see how a Republican Party adapts to Mr. Trump, whether these candidates embrace him or whether they run away from it. There's one Republican I did not mention that's still considering. He's not in the race, and that's Charles Cook. He's an immigration lawyer. And that could be a
he's represented some of these students who sued the Board of Regents over
tuition. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And if he gets into the race, I'm not sure he will. But if he does, that'll be a very interesting conversation.
There's also about three Democrats have talked about it this time, and so they'll probably be a credible Democratic candidate as well.
Oh, yeah.
But the district leans Republican. The unique thing is these special elections. It'll be interesting when
it's
or often
lose produce to, interesting results.
Right. This will be nonpartisan. So you do have the potential if Democrats can kind of consolidate their vote, they could maybe get a second berth in a runoff.
Correct.
And a lot of people are wondering, is Betty Price going to run?
That's Tom Price's wife.
That's Tom Price,
who's now
wife.
Serving in the state house.
Yes.
And that would actually change the race again. Then I think it might not be a race about Tom about Donald Trump. It might be a race about the Affordable Care Act and what to do with it.
Hmm.
Because Betty Price, like her husband, is a physician.
There might be some questions about ethics and how to handle finances and conflict of interest too.
So when we look at the results from the 2016 presidential race by congressional district, I believe it went Trump, but only by about 2 points, right?
Yeah, it was just a slight Trump win. Normally, that district would have been a more heavily Republican district, but Trump barely won it. Again, in a special election, you usually have a tenth of the turnout you do in a normal general election. So we saw a 70% Democratic district get elect a Republican, but when it came back to a normal general election, the incumbent was ousted by a 70% margin.
Yeah, Julianne can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think Marco Rubio took it in the presidential primary.
I believe you're correct.
And John Kasich came next, and Trump was actually third
in the Republican primary.
I believe you're correct.
Probably had a lot of maybe some split ticket voters in November, maybe voting for Hillary Clinton and also voting for Tom Price.
It's going to be the diehards that show up for the special election.
So, Steve Henson, with that in mind, are Democrats going to try to make this race competitive?
Well, we've got a lot of good candidates. Former State Rep Sally Harrell and former State Senator Ron Slotin and John Ossoff, who has worked on campaigns and very active and said he's got a lot of financial commitments, along with, I think, Hank Johnson, John Lewis.
And I think Stacey Abrams is behind him, the House Democratic leader.
They're all sharp people.
So I would, right now, I think you see an attempt to a Democratic attempt to gather around John Ossoff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
he's already raised a lot of money, hasn't he?
He's got a lot of commitments. He's raised a good bit of money, and he's got a lot of commitments out there. So, he comes from a family that's active in Georgia politics and on a lot of important issues to Democrats. So, it's going to be interesting to see the intensity that you've talked about at the rallies. Usually Democrats have not fared well on special elections with turnout. But the intensity out there, it will be interesting to see whether or not people are going to be motivated paying attention to turnout in large numbers, especially on the Democratic side. And also with a lot of candidates on the Republican side, there is the potential of a fractious, whether it's pro-Trump against Trump or pro-business or the other Republican Party, you know, there could be a fractious primary that could maybe alienate some Republican voters. So it'd be interesting, and there'll be some national attention since it is the first thing since Trump. And so the Democratic candidate will have a lot of people wanting to make a symbolic effort.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that as well. And just ahead, we're going to talk about some of the other developments this week in politics. You're listening to Political Rewind on GPP.
Integrating refugees and migrants into Germany's workforce has been challenging. Now, an online job portal is connecting them with companies that need their specific skill sets.
You know, it's not easy to live as a refugee. And now I have my own job and I can afford my life.
I'm Robert Siegel. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is 4 to 7 this afternoon right here on GPB.
This is Political Rewind on GPB. I'm Bradley George filling in for Bill Nigut. We're joined by Jim Galloway and Bill Torpy from the AJC, Republican consultant Julianne Thompson, and Democratic State Senator Steve Henson. So we're going to talk about, we've got about a little less than 15 minutes left in the show, so we'll talk about some of the other developments in the week in politics. Jim, yesterday, a big decision out of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in California, continuing to put Donald Trump's travel ban on hold, and this is an issue that could very well end up before the Supreme Court.
Yeah, this was the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, a three-judge panel, a Carter appointee, I think a George W. appointee, and an Obama appointee.
And it was a 3-0.
It was a 3-0 decision, and among the main points was, number one, on standing, which I found was very interesting. The court said that, the state of Washington had standing, and that through its public universities, because its faculty recruitment and student activities were being restricted. So I found that very interesting. And it also pushed aside the very specific Trump administration claim that a court had no jurisdiction over national security issues. And it very bluntly rebutted that.
And Trump had his own blunt rebuttal for that very quickly on Twitter, saying, "We will see you in court."
Well, I think they already had.
Julianne, from a political standpoint, the travel ban for Republicans, and particularly how it's rolled out and some of the real issues that this has caused for people who maybe they hold dual citizenship or they have green cards and they had difficulty getting back into the United States. As you talk to Republicans, what are they saying about this?
I think that by and large they support the idea of the travel ban, but not the way it was implemented. They think that there was that the implementation, that the planning wasn't sound, and certainly I was disappointed in the attorney for the Justice Department in the way that it was presented before the Ninth Circuit. I didn't think he was prepared at all. If he would have been more prepared, he could have knocked out the issue with regard to precedent or standing with regard to the students. I mean, by going back to the Carter administration, when the Carter administration not only did a travel ban on Iran, but actually revoked the visas of current students in the United States who were Iranian, and he actually deported them. So, I mean, I'm not saying we should do that. I'm just saying that they could have used that issue, and he didn't. He just seemed very unprepared. So I was disappointed in the arguments.
I think Americans should also understand that just because this is blocked, it doesn't mean we're open, for terrorists to come to America. You know, under the 8 years there was of Obama, there might have been a lot of rhetoric, but actually he deported more illegal aliens than the previous administration. He also had very strict vetting for refugees and vetting for other people coming to even getting a visa and coming to the United States. I can assure you that, intelligence services are checking people, checking their names, vetting them in every way they can to make sure that we continue to prevent people who mean to do us harm from coming to this country. And we have to understand, too, I think a lot of people that look at the ban, your knee-jerk reaction is, heck, you know, we don't need people from Iraq here anyway. So that, you know, and you forget about, you know, the families that live in this country. You forget about the people from these countries that have actually fought with our soldiers or served in some capacity to help this country, and the message that we're sending to them may be detrimental to our long-term
goals. That's a good point. I was about a year ago in Brandon Hills, a terrible little subdivision in DeKalb County that had a lot of issues. And while I was going around there, I ran across a fellow from Afghanistan who is an interpreter. And he had come here because his life was at danger. His best friend had been killed. The family member had been killed. And there are, you know, certainly those types of people who
served with the U.S. military as an interpreter.
And you know, in fact, I talked to several of the soldiers who we had served with, who were just adamant about how much they wanted him and others like him brought into the country, that it helped those people. So,
you know, it's interesting. I mean, yeah, Trump had a defeat at the appeals court, but it could actually end up helping him push through his Supreme Court nominee, because you had help me with the pronunciation, Bradley. Gorsuch. Yes. Mr. Gorsuch has been making the rounds of Congress, and in a conversation with one Democratic senator, one Republican senator, he said that he found Trump's reaction to the court challenges, the so-called judge tweet and such, to be demoralizing. And not demeaning. There was another D word. I'm not
sure.
Disheartening. There we go. Disheartening. You know, so you had a Supreme Court nominee who was able to put some air between him and a president that Democrats don't trust. And, you know, maybe Democrats are getting played. I don't know. But it seemed to help him a little bit with he's going to need, eight Democratic senators to get to the 60 vote margin.
Yeah.
So it might have helped him.
I don't know anyone, even anyone in the Republican Party, that thinks that Trump should have tweeted what he did about the so-called judge. Mm-hmm. Everyone wishes that he would stay off of Twitter. I mean, that's kind of a universal agreement. But with regard to refugees, I agree with what you were saying, both of you gentlemen, just a few minutes ago, that there are many people that are in this country that should be in this country from a lot of those nations that were under the travel ban. I read a Facebook post the other day this was from somebody that this just happened to a couple of days ago. He was in a taxi and he was in an Uber, and his Uber driver was a former interpreter from one of those nations, and his family members were killed. And he came over here and he became an Uber driver, and he's very much a part of the American fabric now, and he would not have been able to come over here under the travel ban. Like I said, I believe that the motives behind the travel ban were to protect our country, because with the exception of Iran, none of the other countries really have a centralized government right now, and no paper trails, no technology, no real thorough way to vet people other than just the question and answer period that goes on during the year-long or two-year-long process. And so I do definitely think that there needs to be a reformulation of the questioning, and there are a lot of people in the intelligence community that are saying that, and I think that there's a way that we can solve this problem. But I do think the intentions were good, just not the implementation.
Well, I think in general, I think a lot of people would like to see the hyperbole or even demagoguery kind of tail down a notch, because you've got a lot of young people out there on internet searches, looking at different information, and we've seen some people radicalized. And this kind of, some of the things coming out of this administration, I think, are concerning, that they might play in the hands of extremists, and hopefully that'll be well thought out in the future.
Well, you know, we're getting ready to enter. I mean, we already are there in a sense, but we're going to see this more and more, a really intense period talking about immigration and talking about borders, because of course Trump's talked about the border wall and has said that we're going to build it. And we had this proposal this week from Georgia's own David Perdue to cut legal immigration to the U.S. in half.
Right, and Tom Cotton.
Tom Cotton from Arkansas signed on to that, too.
Picking up the banner of Jeff Sessions of Alabama, if you will, who's as he moves over to the AG's office. And this is a this is not, we're not, this is legal immigration. We're not talking about illegal immigration, but we're, and we're also not talking about HB1 visas, corporations seeking out employees to bring over here. These are, this is the teeming masses group that's etched on the Statue of Liberty, and they want to draw it down from 1 million to 500,000, and their reasoning is that is to boost low wage, the wages of lower income workers.
And do they have any data to prove it?
Well, I mean, it was interesting. Tom Cotton got up and said, "Well, yes, it might be. This might be about automation. It also might be about globalization." I would throw in. He didn't. I would throw in unions. The decline in unions has impacted wages a great deal. But he and David Perdue seem to think that if we cut down these, if we reduce by $500,000 500,000 entries a year, that lower wages will creep up. And the answer to your question is no. There's no empirical evidence. It's more of a gut supply and demand argument.
And this is just, I mean, this is a proposal, and there are many, you know, lawmakers propose bills all the time. But in my mind, it's significant because David Perdue is somebody who has Donald Trump's ear. He's been an ally of his for a while. So I wonder if this is something that would gain traction among Republicans in the House and the Senate.
Well, he thinks that they can attract enough. He thinks that there may be some action on it by sometime this year. Things do move slowly, and they're making a pitch to Democrats, especially those dependent on union support. To be truthful, I mean that was a
key group for Donald Trump,
Trump
in places
right,
like
exactly.
Ohio.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, your white union aging union workers were solidly behind him.
Steve Hinson, how are Democrats thinking about this new world where white union voters in Ohio are voting for Trump and supporting policies like this?
Listen, it's nothing new. I mean, you know, back in the day, Teamsters endorsed Nixon, and a lot of white blue-collar workers have voted Republican in previous elections. The union leadership probably saw a world that affects their pocketbooks a little more, and saw that the policies the Republicans tend to support, expanding right to work. We've seen that happen just recently in Kentucky, and national right to work policies that make it harder for people to organize being talked about in Congress. They didn't support Trump. But a lot of, whether you're union or not union, you know, you're touched by the same issues. And, you know, a lot of this demagoguery of, you know, locking out foreigners or whatever played into white Americans across the country because they maybe didn't understand the complete issues, just like this issue of cutting from 1 million to 500,000. I mean, you know, a lot of people are going to say, well, it should be 50,000 or zero. But they need to look at what we are part of the international community. You got to realize a lot of these people that come to the country are family members of people already here. You've got to look at what the true effects on our economy is.
Declining birth rate.
And we have got to end it there. We've reached the end of this Friday edition of Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, Julianne Thompson, Steve Hinson, Bill Torpy, thank you all so much for joining us. And thank you for listening. Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming up next on your GPB station. I'm Bradley George, in for Bill Nygut. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. We'll be back with you on Monday.